Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, Election Day, June 5. Today we vote. Tonight you can listen to the results at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow we'll talk about it, as if we haven't already talked about it for what seems like years, but we will talk about it tomorrow. This hour, Frank DeFord is joining us. I have never spoken with Frank, but I've heard him on the radio so many times. Do you know he's been doing his commentaries for NPR? Although people still say to him, we have to brand ourselves a little better. I heard you on PBS. No, it was NPR. Since 1979, he has written his memoir, Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer, which has just been released. He, of course, senior contributing editor at Sports Illustrated. He's a regular correspondent on the HBO show Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. He has written 18 books. And this particular book is about sports writers and what he thinks of them, who influenced him, some of the teachers who influenced him, and some of the people he followed, particularly moving his story of Arthur Ashe, who he says he was probably closest to Arthur Ashe of all the people in the sports world that he covered. And it's an extraordinary story. So, Frank is with us this hour to talk about all kinds of sports-related things. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, and people are calling in already, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also go to the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook if you would like. Hello, Frank.
Kathleen, it's good to be, I think, a public service today as a diversion from the recall. So.
You are
thank
our
you very much.
We got the best diversion we could find, you know, that, and it's you.
I'm sure everybody in Wisconsin is glad to talk about anything but the recall.
I think you're right, until tomorrow, right? We need a break from it. I love your voice. You just have, I know people say this to you all the time, but they talk about distinctive voices, and boy, oh boy, do you have one.
It amazes me to hear that, because nobody ever told me that till I was on NPR, I guess, when I was 40 years old. Nobody ever said, you have a distinctive voice. Maybe it's because nobody ever trained me to have a distinctive voice. And this is just what I got. But I'm delighted to have one.
Well, I hear you. It's on Wednesdays, right? Wednesdays on NPR, I hear you as I'm getting my coffee ready and trying to do the dishes and come and do my show. And I always, and there's Frank. Oh, yeah, Frank is on today. It's your voice that just sort of, there it is. It's just right out in the air in the kitchen, which is a good thing.
I think it's sort of the equivalent. We talk about the Mid-Atlantic voice between the United States and England. I think mine is sort of mid-Atlantic, if you will. sort of nobody can place it. And I don't know why that is, Kathleen, but that's the way it is.
That's the way it should be. Nobody can place it. A lot of mystery about you, Frank. I had no idea you were, and I looked at the pictures in the book as I was reading it, and then I loved your line about Abraham Lincoln. I had no idea you were as tall as you are. You're a tall guy. And I love the line, because I'm tall, people naturally assume I played basketball. Every tall guy gets that, including, you think, when people meet Abraham Lincoln in heaven.
they naturally say to him, "Not, aren't you the guy that did the Gettysburg Address?" They know. They say, "Hey, did you play basketball?" It's a natural inquiry to, and you know, when people see small people, they don't say, "Hey, were you ever a jockey?"
Right.
It's just the basketball analogy that we find.
And you did play basketball for a little while.
Well, I was a terrific, I want to emphasize that, terrific high school player, and then I was a flop thereafter. But I peaked early. I peaked at the age of 18, and it was all downhill from there.
But you happened to be able to notice and bring to national prominence Bill Bradley, who's very much worthy of being brought to national prominence on a whole host of reasons. But you knew all about him, and nobody else did, huh?
I have told Bill often that he was a springboard to my career, because Bill was a freshman at Princeton. And in those days, the NCAA did not allow freshmen to play on the varsity. So I was a senior when he was a freshman. And how many people saw freshman Ivy League basketball games? Not a whole lot. And when I graduated that June, after Bill's freshman year, I go to Sports Illustrated, and that fall I told them that the best sophomore was this kid from Princeton, and they all naturally laughed at me. You know, the best basketball players are supposed to come from UCLA and Ohio State and so forth. But I persisted, and they sort of threw me a bone and let me do a story on him. One of the very first stories that I did, Bill turned out to be far better than even I expected, and that made me look like a genius. They said, this kid really knows his stuff. And so did Bill Bradley make the career of Frank DeFord.
But it's all right. You did your part, too. And Bill Bradley turned out to have a pretty spectacular career in a lot of areas, huh?
I think that, yeah. Bill did not need me nearly so much as I needed Bill. I would have loved to have seen Bill Bradley become president of the United States, but that's long gone.
Yeah, he would have been an extraordinarily good president, I would think. He's a very smart man and a caring man.
He only lost the New Hampshire primary. I looked this up when I was writing the book. He lost the New Hampshire primary to Al Gore by like 300 or 400 votes.
Really? I didn't know that.
It was very close. And had he won that, then if we get into momentum, and who knows what would have happened thereafter, but I have a feeling that the entire history of the 21st century would have been quite different.
Yeah.
Such as 300 votes.
Right. Right. All right. Well, we have so much to cover. So let me ask, such a simple question, but I know you're going to have an interesting response to this. The greatest athlete who ever lived, Jackie Robinson?
That's what I say, but I think it's one of those bar arguments, Kathleen.
Right.
You know, anybody can make an argument for several people. People say, what do you mean, Jackie Robinson? I say it's Jim Brown. And somebody says, no, it was Jim Thorpe. And you can go on and on and on. And it's like saying, who was the greatest painter? Who was the was Mozart better than Beethoven? I mean, we can talk about it forever. But I would vote for Jackie Robinson. And baseball was really like his fourth best sport, and he ended up in the Hall of Fame.
Remarkable.
So that's good enough for me.
And how difficult it must have been, I guess we tend to forget this, but for Hank Aaron as well, to have to play through the racial epithets that were thrown at him and the death threats, too. Oh, my goodness, how hard that must have been.
You know, I had a fabulous conversation one time with Henry Aaron, who I did not know, but we did a charity dinner together just by chance, and I believe it was Charlotte, North Carolina. And as we left the dinner, we went back to the hotel together, and then I said politely goodnight, and he said, well, wouldn't you like to have a beer? I said, sure. And so I sat down with Henry, and we must have had two or three beers. And one of the things that he said, I said stupidly, I said, what a shame that you didn't ever get to play in New York or Los Angeles and get all the publicity that you would have gotten. And he said, very simply, he said, had I played there, I never would have succeeded nearly so well as I did in Milwaukee and
really?
Atlanta. In other words, it was better for him not to be in the brightest of spotlights.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know.
Yeah.
I mean, he thinks that he achieved because he was able to do it more quietly.
Mm. You write about Sports Illustrated and the fact that it took a long time for black athletes to be on the cover of the magazine, and when it came to commercial endorsements, second-rate white players would get the gig.
Mm-hmm. Maybe some of your older listeners would remember something called the Jansen Athletic Club, which was all these guys in Jansen bathing suits, and they were all white athletes. It was a long, long time before a black guy was included. And you're absolutely right that there would be an endorsement given in some city for a car or whatever, and it would invariably go to the third or the fourth best athlete in town who was white, rather than to the star black. Now, of course, all that has been turned on its head because nobody became a greater endorser probably in the history of media than Michael Jordan.
Right.
So it didn't take long for changes to take place. I think once the advertising people and the commercial people understood that the fans were sort of ahead of them, that the fans would listen to a black guy as well as a white guy. Then it sort of all changed overnight, and then Jordan came along and blew the whole theory quite apart.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested, Frank, in finding out how people have a chance to do what it is they love to do, and I'd love to hear your Princeton story and your interview story at Time, Inc., many years ago, and how you finally were able to do what you obviously love to do, and you're very, very good at it. But how did it happen?
All I wanted, Kathleen, was to be a writer. Most sports writers want to be sports writers from the time they're little boys, or now little girls as well. And I just wanted to be a writer. But I wanted to go to New York. And I was quite admiring of Sports Illustrated as a literary property. The managing editor was a guy named André Laguerre, who was a Frenchman. It was a Frenchman who really made Sports Illustrated work in the United States. That's one of the idiosyncrasies. Laguerre had been de Gaulle's press secretary during the war.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he was quite a character. And in any event, when I went up to interview for the Time Incorporated, a group of magazines, they gave me a folder that I was supposed to take around and hand to the prospective people who might employ me. And I really didn't care about any of the other magazines. And Kathleen, I snuck a peek into the folder. Now, nobody told me not to, but you would have had to be impossibly incurious not to sneak a peek. I thought just right. My clips were in there. But there was a little summary, and at the top of the summary, these were the first words. Not very bright.
Oh,
okay. So I'm going to hand this. Can you understand? I'm going to hand this to the person who might employ me. And now, granted, based on my grades at Princeton, that was a perfectly apt analysis. I did not do well on standardized tests, I guess. Any event, rather than upsetting me, which it might have done initially, it got my back up. And I pretty much told the people from Time and Life and Fortune and so forth, I don't want to work for your lousy magazine anyhow, right? They weren't going to hire this not very bright guy. And I wasn't smart enough to figure this all out. But the word gets back to Sports Illustrated that this cocky kid, he wants to work for us. And at that time, Sports Illustrated was still losing money, was kind of looked down upon as this D-class, sweaty journal that was lowering the standards of Time Incorporated. By lunchtime, I was in the executive dining room with the Sports Illustrated editors. By the end of the day, I had met Mr. Laguerre, the managing editor, and pretty much been guaranteed a job.
And isn't that something?
That's how I got my start at Sports Illustrated, because I was not very bright.
Who the heck wrote that about you? What a terrible thing to write about somebody.
I know it's a terrible thing to write, but as I say, if you looked at my grades, and they really were terrible, it's one of the great regrets of my life. When I was 65, I wrote all the things down that I wished I'd done or wished I could do. And one of them was that I wished I'd taken more advantage of college. But I spent all my time either writing or having a good time, and very little time studying, which is, after all, what you're supposed to do at college. And so in that sense, it was a perfectly fair analysis. Mm,
but think of all the
and
time.
And it did say something like, but I do think he can write. I
yes,
do think he can
yes.
string sentences together. You know, maybe he can write captions for Life magazine.
Yeah. You showed him, didn't you? You showed
him. I showed him.
Yeah. Frank DeFord is our guest this hour. He has a new book. It's his first memoir, Over Time, which has just been published. It's a great read. It's about his life, of course, how he came to do what he does, the sports writers who he was reading when he was a kid and older, the people he's covered in the sports world. He talks about journalism and the internet and all of that in his book. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Here's how you reach us. One line is open right now, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page, if you want to leave comments there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, of course, is Election Day in the state of Wisconsin, and we will be giving you the returns starting at 8 o'clock tonight. I don't know if you've ever listened to this station for election returns, but we have reporters all over the state because we're a network, as you know, of various facilities in Superior and Wausau and La Crosse and Green Bay and Madison and Milwaukee. So, and the people are good who give you the news and who will analyze what's been happening. So that's tonight, and it's at 8 o'clock. And if you're looking for a place to listen, it's a good place to listen. Tomorrow we will be doing an analysis of all that happened in the state of Wisconsin today. So stay tuned. Joy will have 3 hours tomorrow morning. In our 9 o'clock hour, we will talk about today's vote. Let's go to phone calls. Frank DeFord is our guest this hour, and Mike in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Well, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's been two parallel unfulfilled expectations I've been hearing about since I was a boy in the 1960s. The invention of nuclear fusion reactors replacing fission reactors, and soccer rivaling baseball in popularity. Now, the justification for nuclear fusion was that we understood the physics of nuclear fusion pretty well, and the technological breakthrough is just on the horizon. The justification for soccer rivaling baseball in popularity was the influx of European, Mexican, and South American immigrants bringing their enthusiasm for watching and playing soccer to this country, resulting in a paradigm shift from baseball to soccer that's just around the corner. Fast forward to 2012, and I still hear the same justifications and projections for both, but neither has happened. So I wanted to ask Frank, which will happen first? Nuclear fusion reactors or soccer rivaling baseball in popularity in this country? And I'll take any.
Oh, you gotta love public radio, don't you, Frank? That's a great question.
Yeah. I think coal fusion will be around before soccer will replace baseball or football or basketball. See, the thing about soccer is in the United States, it's had every chance. It's been around for years. It was back in the 19th century, and we rejected it then. Kids grow up playing soccer. What do we call them? Soccer moms. We don't call them baseball moms, right? Kids grow up, and then as soon as their voice change or whatever, they say, well, that's enough for soccer, and they turn to other sports. And so it's perfectly apparent, and soccer people don't want to hear this, but it's perfectly apparent that we reject soccer. We simply don't like it as much as the other sports. I think it's simply that soccer is a very simple sport, which is why it's gained so much popularity all over the world. It's magnificently cheap. I've seen it, played in the poorest countries in the world, and we have the option to like other sports, and we do. The thing that drives me crazy, Kathleen, is soccer people get mad at you for not liking soccer.
I know.
I know. What's the matter with you? Everybody in the world likes soccer except Americans, so there must be something wrong with you. And, I don't care if some guy in Uruguay doesn't like baseball. That's fine for me. But soccer people, American soccer people, I think feel like they've sort of let the gods of soccer down. And they're very upset. And obviously, we just find other sports more entertaining. It's as simple as that.
You do, Frank. I don't. I love soccer. But I don't want to start an argument. I think it's a beautiful game. It's the beautiful game.
It's a beautiful game in which people do not use their hands, which we use for every other thing that we do. I mean, the hands are what God gave us to separate us from the beast of the field. And yet we don't use them in soccer, and people call it beautiful.
Well, we don't use them in Irish.
I always said, can we just imagine the Sistine Chapel? If God was touching Adam, not finger to finger, but foot to foot, that would
That's
be soccer.
Funny. Well, you're not an Irish dancing fan then either, huh? They don't use their hands either, but they're really good. They're good. Thank you, Mike, for that wonderful call.
Thank you, Mike. Indeed, Mike. Thank you.
Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Speaking of must-listen radio, when you had your open line yesterday, I called in. to suggest that you get Frank DeFord to talk about his new book.
Oh, Overtime. My gosh. Oh.
And producer Brett said, you know, you might want to be around the radio tomorrow. So here I am.
Oh, Scott. We did it just for you.
You know, thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah.
You just read my mind, and that's the way it should work. And
Scott's my advanced man.
Right.
obviously, Mr. DeFord, I'm a admirer of yours, and I look forward to reading your book, definitely so. But the, I'll stop gushing and ask my question. If you had the opportunity to interview one individual sports figure from before you were on the scene, who would that be and why? Who intrigues you from the past?
It's interesting that you couched it that way, because people usually, when they ask that question, they say, of all the people that you haven't had a chance to interview, who would you like? And I think they expect the answer to be something like Tiger Woods. But I agree with you. If I want to interview somebody, I want to interview somebody before I came along. You know, Babe Ruth jumps immediately to mind simply because he was the extraordinary athlete probably of all time and was so dominant. Whether he would have been all that charming, I don't know. There might have Babe might have had a lot to say for a few minutes and then not a whole lot to say. Somebody controversial like Ty Cobb, who was mean and racist and yet bright, might have been a very, very interesting character to talk to. So I would incline in that direction. Another interesting person would have been Jack Johnson, the first great black heavyweight champion, who was such a controversial figure. You always are looking not just for people who are nice, but, you know, as a journalist, you're looking for somebody with an edge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody had more of an edge than Jack Johnson.
Hmm. That's a great question. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. You spend a lot of time in the book, and you say that Arthur Ashe, one of your favorite guys of all time, you got closer to Arthur than any other athlete that you have ever covered. Why? Why Arthur Ashe?
A lot of it was just the fact that we were about the same age.
Hmm.
That was one of the great advantages, Kathleen, by the way, of being at Sports Illustrated and getting to write about the best athletes at such a young age, because I was their contemporary.
Hmm.
You know, as a sports writer, the older you get, the further you get away, in effect.
Oh, that's true.
From the people that you're covering.
Yes.
And so obviously the athletes that I were closest with were those when I was growing up too. Arthur and I just found an awful lot in common. It was almost incidental that he was black and I was white. We had many of the same interests, and then we traveled together and got to know each other even better. I mean, Arthur was a pallbearer for when my daughter died of cystic fibrosis. He was one of the people who was a pallbearer, and he was a very caring guy. And yet, and this is what's the point I always want to make, he was tremendous company. Because he died tragically and because he was identified with so many serious causes, I think people think that Arthur was very sort of sober-sided. Well, he was an intellectual, but he was also an awful lot of fun, and we just enjoyed each other's company.
Mm-hmm.
Loved to talk about anything, argue about anything, and I had the privilege, more than anything else, of going to South Africa and actually living with Arthur when he broke the color line there, which was a major story.
Yeah, it was a major story.
Yeah, once Arthur was the first athlete or performer, really, I don't think any entertainer had done this either, to appear on the stage or, in his case, the court with a white person. Once he sort of pulled that curtain back and let the light in, there was no closing the curtain back up, and it was only another 20 years before Nelson Mandela was president of the country.
Yeah, another extraordinary story.
And Arthur really started the process. He really did. When years later, when Mandela was released from jail, and they said, "Who would you like to meet?" He said, "Arthur Ashe."
Oh, let's talk a little bit about your daughter. And let me just read what you wrote. I hope that by writing, you wrote a memoir, Alex, The Life of a Child, that by writing about this one extraordinary little person, I would give a face to a disease, cystic fibrosis, which was then struggling to achieve the recognition it needed to secure research funds. And as a father who was a writer, I would have felt simply irresponsible had I not written the story about what was the most important thing that had happened in your life. It did bring research. It did bring money to examine cures for, help for people with cystic fibrosis, didn't it?
She gave cystic fibrosis a face. It was just before that. It was sort of a faceless disease, one of those alphabet diseases. And that doesn't mean people are cruel or uncaring. It's just that so much is thrown at them. And all of a sudden, here was this little girl, and this beautiful little girl, and you could see, or in the case of the book, read about her and what she was like, and not just as a sick person, but as a cute, fun person. And all of a sudden, there was cystic fibrosis with an identity, and in that sense, she was very important in raising the visibility of cystic fibrosis, and therefore bringing money in, and therefore helping the research. And when Alex died in 1980, she was 8, and the average age was about that lifespan. And today, it's approaching 40, and we're very close to finding a control, which will mean that cystic fibrosis people will live the same long lives as you or me. And having written about Alex, though, and that book, which I think was published in like 83, 84, in a way, it freed me from this, in this memoir, to dwell on happier things.
Right.
So this is a sort of a companion volume to that one about Alex and the most compelling and tragic part of my life, and over time is much more about the happier times and the fascinating people that I got to know.
Yeah, it's been quite a life, hasn't it, Frank? I mean, it's not over yet, but you've had quite a life.
It really has. I mean, you know, writers write. We don't do things. The picture on the cover is just me sort of embracing a typewriter, an old-fashioned typewriter, back when I had more hair and darker hair. But that's what we do. We write and we take notepads and jot things down. Other people live lives, and the advantage I've had as a writer is that I've been able to live with all these fascinating people and get close to them, like Arthur Ashe, like Billie Jean King, like so many others, and to tell the stories that we shared together.
Let's, Scott, thanks for your call. Doug in Oshkosh. Hi, Doug.
Morning, Frank and Dean. A funny story you mentioned about Abraham Lincoln and heaven and being tall and everything else. Opening weekend of trout fishing is one of my favorite weekends, and we had this couple from Australia. But anyway, their son came to EAA, and so we go down to Herbie's AC Doocy, which is the who's who of EAA. Down there, there are two gorgeous women, one 6'3", one maybe 6'4". They're simply breathtaking. And Bill, I get the son, Bill, he comes over, he's a pilot. And so he comes over and we're there, and he walks up to one of these women. He says, "Hey, mate," he's about 5'6", 5'7", like I said. Anyway, he says, "Hey, mate," he says, "do you play basketball?" And the woman looked down at him. She says, "No, I don't. Do you play putt-putt golf?" I hear you comment about Lincoln. I had a call.
It always intrigues me that when people say to me, "How tall are you?" and I say, "I'm 6'4", they say, "No, you're not. You're taller than that." Nobody has ever said, no, you're not that tall. The other thing, and one time I got on an airplane with Wilt Chamberlain, if you can imagine.
Oh, my
this.
Gosh.
And the flight attendant said, "Watch your head." As if Wilt Chamberlain had not spent a lifetime watching your head. Even at 6'4", you spend a lot of time watching your head, but at 7'2",
right.
And Wilt just nodded and said that he appreciated the advice and that he would indeed watch his head as he just about doubled over walking down the plane.
Doug, thanks so much for the call. Some emails have come in. Celia in Waterloo wants to know your impression of Al McGuire.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My favorite. I never had so much fun in my life as when I did a story with Al McGuire. Al was the only person I've ever met in my life. As a matter of fact, I based a, or at least part of a character on him in one of my novels. Al would say your name at the beginning of a sentence and at the end of the sentence. Kathleen, it's so nice to be on your show, Kathleen. I don't know where that came from. I never heard anybody else. And Al was known for riding around on his motorcycle, right, and being sort of this hot dog on a motorcycle. But when he drove a car, he was the slowest driver that I've ever been with. And when he would get interested in conversation, the car would just sort of drift to a stop. And you'd say, Al, we're on the road. He speaks... He speaks a different language, or he spoke a different language from other people. He there's a whole book of sort of aphorisms from Al. Can I tell one favorite Al story?
Oh, please. People would love it.
So simple. We were in Toronto together. I can't remember what in the world we were doing in Toronto, but there we were in Toronto. We were sort of at this nightclub, and we're sitting there, and the band is playing. And the band strikes up a new number. I'm pretty sure it was Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. That sticks in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And Al turns to me and said, "That'll fill up the dance floor." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Summer Song." He said, "That was a summer song. People always dance more to summer songs." And just like that, the dance floor filled up. He had the most incredible ability to see things out of the corner of his eye. He was absolutely sui generis, Al McGuire. And of course, the wonderful thing about him was that he won the championship for Marquette in his last season. And he'd said, "This is going to be my last season." I mean, how many people go out a winner? And he was a great country and western fan. And in those days, believe it or not, there were still telegrams. And the telegram I sent him was, the name of a country and western song was, which is, "The Girls Get Prettier at Closing Time." And that was the end. That was it. The girls were the prettiest, and he walked off a champion, and one of my favorite people in all of sports.
Oh, I'm so glad that Celia asked about that. That's quite a story. My Laney's from Mequon wants you to address the college athlete pay issue.
I think that's pretty easy to do. If you go back 50 years... just to bring a little historical perspective to it, there were any number of sports which were highly commercialized, where money was made, and yet athletes were expected to take this vow of amateurism, this vow of athletic chastity. Tennis was that way. Skiing was that way. Swimming was that way. Track and field was that way. Rugby was that way. All over the country, all over the world. And one by one, these sports became honest, which is to say the athletes were allowed to make money the same way that musicians are allowed to make money and writers are allowed to make money and all other people in various disciplines are. But this insane idea of amateurism, which was really created by the British upper classes in the 19th century to keep working people from competing with them, because obviously... if you couldn't make money, then you couldn't compete as an athlete. Only today exists in American college basketball and football. That's the only place where big money is made in sport and the athletes don't share in it. And it's absolutely, it's unfair, it's immoral. I think, to be dramatic, it's un-American. And I think we're fast approaching a point where I think it's tilted already. 10 years ago, people who said, "Well, the boys get scholarships, and that should be enough. And now I think more and more people say, no, it's not fair for the coach to get $10 million a year and the university to make hundreds of millions of dollars in television contracts and the players to get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I just could add one more codicil to the will, it is that the football players are also risking their lives and their heads and their limbs and still not getting paid, which makes it even more atrocious and unfair. So I think it won't be long now before college basketball and football players are paid as they should be.
Oh, interesting. And let's
Let's
talk a little more. You write about what you call the fuss that we make over high school sports. Probably the main reason so many men in the U.S. are forever adolescent. High school sports have replaced the Western as the male American lyric. You got away with words, Frank. You got away with words. Why do we have all this fuss over high school sports?
For reasons which you know, nobody has really quite explained to me. America alone has much more of a confluence of athletics and schools and colleges. You go abroad, and that's not the case. I mean, a typical high school in France does not play another typical high school in France in soccer and draw tens of thousands of people. The Sorbonne does not play Cambridge on primetime television. It's pretty much strictly an American convention. It probably had something to do with our heterogeneous we are, our transient. It established a town. But in any event, that's the case. And so many American men, and I suppose we could say American women now, grow up as high school heroes. I mean, you know, they're really celebrated at the age of 15 or 16. And that's the peak of their lives. I mean, I was a high school hero, okay? I'm sort of glad that it ended there. But let me tell you, I can still think about it 50 years ago, standing on a basketball court with the band playing and the pretty cheerleaders with their pom-poms jumping up and down and your girlfriend there and your family and your friends. My God, you may never achieve that for the rest of your life. I mean, honestly, and I think that there are certain men then and a lot of them who sort of look back on that fondly as the peak of their lives. And from a more practical point of view, unfortunately, I think it diverts too many boys away from the classroom to the playing fields. We're reaching a point now where 60% of college students are female. It's a terrible thing that's happening in this country that boys are not paying enough attention to their studies. That's not healthy.
Frank DeFord, our guest this hour. He's so good, isn't he? Just a pleasure to listen to. He has a new book. It's his first memoir. He's a very prolific guy. He's written 18 books. He's senior contributing writer at Sports Illustrated and, of course, the weekly commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. You hear him on Wednesdays. Always worth listening to. Regular correspondent on HBO's Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. And the book, did I say the name of it, is Overtime. Just been published, My Life as a Sports Writer. Frank DeFord is our guest this hour. And here's how you reach us if you'd like to. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, some of you have used that, is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's that. Returning to more conversation and some more interviews that he's done. A lot of the book deals with some of the more eccentric characters, and there are some stories that you simply have to hear him tell. So he will in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So we have this big election going on today in Wisconsin. We've spent a long time talking about the issues, and now today we're voting, and tonight the election results will be coming in, and you can hear them on our superb election coverage, 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. Frederica Freiberg and Sean Johnson will be taking care of the microphones, and we have reporters and volunteers and people who work for public radio and volunteer with public radio who are going to various polling places all over the state of Wisconsin. So it's really very good election coverage, and that's tonight at 8. And tomorrow we will talk about it. That starts with Joy's show in the morning, and we'll talk about it the first hour of our show. Frank DeFord is our guest this hour, 800-486-8655. I want you to tell the story, because it's of all the people you interviewed, and you say this would be the top of your interview list. It's a hysterically funny and very unusual story of, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Sada Haru Oh, the Babe Ruth of Japan. That is quite a story, Frank. It's quite a story.
Yeah. Osan, Mr. O. The great Japanese home run hitter.
Oh, yeah.
And I was sent to Tokyo to do a story on when he was at the height of his powers. I guess this is back in the late 1970s or so. And I got over there. I mean, obviously, it had been set up in advance. I wasn't just going to fly 12,000 miles and drop in. It was understood that Mr. Rowe and I would have a conversation. But every day I would go to the ballpark, and we would bow at each other. And I would say in my pigeon Japanese hello, and he would say in his pigeon English hello. But that was sort of the extent of it. And the translator didn't seem to suggest that there would ever be this conversation. And finally, I had to bring it up. My wife goes with me to good places. You know, she doesn't go to Wichita with me, but she goes to Tokyo. She got annoyed with the whole thing and went down to Kyoto as a tourist. And finally, I said to the translator, "Listen, when am I going to get a chance to talk to Mr. O?" And he said, "Well, tomorrow would be fine." I said, "That's great." And he said, "But you can't talk to Mr. O here. You have to take him out to dinner." Well, that was even better, to get him away from the ballpark, to get alone with Mr. O. This was, and I said, "Terrific." And he said, "But you can't just take Mr. O out to any restaurant." I said, "I can't." He said, "No, he's too popular. You have to rent the whole restaurant." Luckily, the yen had not climbed to paramount heights at that point. And, of course, I was on expense account. I finally negotiated it that I could have the top floor of a restaurant.
Oh, Frank.
And, indeed, Mr. O bought about 50 of his friends, who then munched on a nice buffet there and enjoyed sake and beer. And Mr. O and I sat in the corner with the translator while all his friends imbibed, ingested, and we had a couple of beers and talked. And you know, Kathleen, I've always found this out. Translators, something, I call the chapter "Something is Lost in Translation," right. And it is. You just, it just doesn't wash. You lose too much going through. But we had a nice conversation. I think nothing was gained by it. And I talked to Italian soccer players and had the same response, that nothing really comes out of it. But at least Mr. O is the only time that I've ever had to rent an entire restaurant.
Just it's such a story, Frank. It's really, you could write a whole little short story about that. I think you should sometime. It's very funny.
You probably could. And let me tell you, they ran up a pretty good bill.
I'll bet they did. And you got a bad interview. You got
a bad interview. But a lot of good food.
Right, a lot of good food.
I guess it was sushi. I don't know. I'm not a sushi eater myself. But Mr. O and I had a couple of beers together. And he's a very nice gentleman. I'll say that, even if I did not pry the great secrets out of him that I had hoped to.
Dave in Sister Bay. Hi, Dave.
Oh, thank you. I was on the heels of that. My question was basically going to be, who of all the people you've interviewed you would say it was the most just naturally charming, engaging, like you'd wanted to spend, you know, a couple of afternoons with them, really get to know them outside of just sports? Obviously, it would be an English-speaking person. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
I already mentioned McGuire.
Mm-hmm.
And I really would. I'm not just saying this because this is Wisconsin on recall day. I really would put Al at the top of the tree. But let me be general. I have always found that I would rather interview a woman than a man.
Really?
Yep, and it works the other way around, too. I would rather have a woman interview me than a man.
Really?
I just think it's sort of natural. I've said that an interview is really just a high school date taken to a higher power. It really is, and you sort of prepare yourself for life by, you know, interviewing dates, right? What's your favorite color? What do you like? What music do you like? And I'm being facetious when I say that, but I do think there's sort of an element of flirtation, sexuality, whatever you want to call it, that kind of perks the conversation up.
Hmm.
And maybe I'm saying that because as a sports writer, most of the people that I've interviewed have been men, right?
Right.
Because they've been so dominant. But I could name, and don't laugh at me, a couple of roller derby skaters named Ann Covallo and Joan Weston, who were so guileless, so much fun, so interesting, that I put them, you know, way above so many male superstars. And I just, you know, think men get along better with women that way, and women get along with men.
You know, I've never thought about it, and I've done interviews for how many
maybe
years?
Maybe I'm stereotyping.
I'll have to think about it.
Maybe I'm Jamie Ice. The highlight of my career, such as it is with regard to my professional career with women, was when I was the MC of the 25th anniversary Sports Illustrated swimsuit
tour. Oh, my.
And I flew across America in the corporate jet with the likes of Rachel Hunter and Elle McPherson and Carol Alt. I was the only man on the plane, except for the pilot, and he had to fly the bloody thing. So that was, I guess that was the height of my career. in that part of my career.
Let's go to Ellen in Minneapolis. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. So I am a magazine editor and writer of about 1.5 years now. And so I was just wondering what Frank thinks about the current situation with print journalism and if he has any advice for those of us who are just starting out and hope to make a whole career out of it like he has.
Oh, God, Ellen, I think I hate being old. But I do think I got the best years out of the profession. I really do. I think the last half of the 20th century was maybe the best time ever to be a print journalist. And now I just think everything is into a cocked hat, and it's so hard to give any advice because I don't think anybody knows what lies around the corner. I think it's clear that more and more digitalization is upon us. I mean, we essentially lost another print newspaper in the last few days when the New Orleans Picayune decided to only print 2 days a week. I mean, I think everybody can see the direction in which we're heading. And maybe if I could come back in 50 years, I'd be perfectly happy to hold an iPad in my hand at the breakfast table instead of a real newspaper. I think the best advice I can give you is to be as versatile as you possibly can. I think it was much easier for people of my vintage and even later to say, this is what I want to be. I want to be an editor for this kind of magazine. I want to cover this beat for newspapers. And I don't think that you can hope directly as much as you could in the past. I think you have to be prepared to take whatever is offered you, because I think it's a time of absolute flux before we figure out who's going to pay for journalism. And that's really the problem right now. And paying for the big stuff, investigative journalism, the long stories, those are what are taking the biggest the biggest hits.
And they're so important, too. We have 20 seconds.
Yes, they're the most important part.
Yes, they sure are.
Never mind, you know, who's hit, who's winning the ball games. That's never going to be a problem.
Yeah.
It's going to be finding out who the scoundrels are. That's the tricky part.
Yeah, Bill, you got 15 seconds.
Frank, I just wanted to comment. You did a story on Brett Favre one Wednesday morning about a year ago. It was a great wake-up call for old people. We can still get out there and do it. God bless you.
Hey, thank you very much. I hope you'll say that a year from now. Favre is gone, but DeFord remains.
DeFord remains. Thank you, Frank, so much for the hour. It was really delightful. Thank you.
Kathleen, I hope I diverted people from the recall for just a few minutes.
Oh, yes, you have. Completely. Completely. Frank DeFord, the book is Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, which has just been published. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this show, and thanks to Brett Jaspers as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Election Day today, results tonight coming in about 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.